Welcome to Schoolin' Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds featuring prominent leaders, subject matter experts, and thought innovators with their perspectives on the current challenges facing K-12 education. I'm your host, Larissa Napolitan, a former teacher, instructional coach, and a member of the Branching Minds team. My hope is to shine a light on phenomenal educators and those that are on a mission to transform our schools and the lives of students. If you're an English teacher, like I was, you know literacy isn't just about reading. It's about writing too. Our guest today, the amazing Patty McGee, is an experienced education consultant who's all about rethinking grammar instruction, sparking creativity, and helping students discover their voice through writing. So let's dive in. Patty, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I was just telling you before we started that when you dropped into my inbox, I looked at your books and your resources, I was like, this is the kind of stuff that I would need as an educator and would have loved to have. And so I'm so excited to share your resources and you with our audience. So I'm glad you're here.
Well, that is music to my ears because that is my full intention in doing this work, in being able to really think educator, student first, and then creating things that can make lives just a little bit easier and still be effective.
That's great. So as an English teacher myself, this is the kind of topic that it's so much fun to have. So let's talk grammar. What's your favorite grammar rule?
I really like the relationship, this is so nerdy, between participial phrases and dangling modifiers.
Okay, explain a little bit for our audience.
So let me start with the dangling modifier or misplaced modifier. That is when we are describing something and then we have comma and then the thing that we're describing coming after the comma. So something like taped to the wall, Larissa read the schedule.
So is Larissa taped to the wall?
That's what that sounds like.
Schedule taped to the wall.
Yes, exactly. So when it taped to the wall, comma, Larissa, that would be you taped to the wall. So that is a dangling modifier. So it's a participial phrase that's been misplaced. And instead it would be taped to the wall, the schedule was read by Larissa, even though that's passive tense, whatever, but like passive voice rather. It's still fun because there's a lot of usage of that. When you find it out in the real world, it can be pretty funny to think about, you know, someone being taped to a wall or like just so many times that it shows up that we don't realize that we are describing the thing after the comma. So I like it because it makes me laugh.
I love that too. It makes me think about, I was explaining comma rules to eighth graders and or talking about the importance of commas in your writing. And I basically went and searched on the internet for just really funny grammar mistakes or comma mistakes. And one of them is like, let's eat grandma versus yes. Like, let's eat comma grandma. And yes. My eighth graders found that hilarious. And so I just think about those kind of things all the time of just how important grammar is. Yes. For our understanding. And so I already could tell this is such a fun conversation because the fact that you're like, this is really nerdy. And I was like, there are going to be some people that are so happy.
Well, something I'm going to share with you then to put in the show notes is I have been collecting grammar memes. So I have a whole slide deck of grammar memes that I keep adding to, and I will share them with you and your audience because that's capturing a lot of the funny stuff that we've been talking about.
Okay. I will love that. I'm sure that our audience will love to use that in some way. That's a great icebreaker for a staff meeting.
Totally.
So let's just start out that, like, in your view, how does writing fit into that bigger picture of literacy? Because that's really what we're talking about. How does that fit into the bigger picture of literacy? And why do you think it's important for us to see literacy as more than just reading?
There are so many reasons. I'm trying to prioritize them in my head as I answer that question. You know, to be a fully literate person, that means that we are not only able to decipher meaning from other people's writing, whatever type that might be, but we're also able to express ourselves in writing to impact people around us, whether that's near or far. And that gives us great power in our lives. When we can write, we can code switch depending on who we are, who our audience is. We can advocate for ourselves, seeing a lot going on across the country. And, you know, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, there's a lot of words that are being used, and words that are chosen really matter in terms of how we represent ourselves. I believe in the power of laughter, finding times where you're almost like bowled over in laughter from writing is also a beautiful, delicious part of life. And then just to get academic about it, academically, writing helps us learn things. Writing helps us share what we've learned. Writing helps us read better. Writing, especially nonfiction, helps us, and this is research from Doug Reeves, helps us in every area of education down to, and this surprised me, multiple choice questions on assessments. And so it's something that I'm sad to say I'm seeing less and less of in districts around the country. And it's, to me, kind of like missing out on like a really important food group. You know, it's like, let's not eat protein any longer. And that, and writing has that kind of impact and leverage in literacy.
Yeah. Well, and I think about how difficult it was, because I began teaching sort of on the tail end of No Child Left Behind. And my understanding, you know, I hopped into a seventh grade classroom, and so much of it was about these reading standards that we had to focus on. And there wasn't really a writing assessment that the kids took at the end of the year. But I knew the skills in seventh grade, like they needed to form a paragraph. They needed to understand. I mean, even if there's a reading standard about thesis, like the idea of understanding the thesis or the main idea. And some of that, I was like, that translates into, they have to be able to write that and articulate that. And so there's so much interwoven. You can't separate those two things because they're so incorporated. And so I think it, you know, it was a disservice that we focused so much on these reading standards that writing was an afterthought. And even in that, grammar was an afterthought. And so really, like, I tried to touch on some grammar rules, and I could tell, like, there are certain students that had teachers earlier on that focused on writing. And but there was such a dichotomy between the different groups of students that it was really hard, like the baseline for where students could be at. And so really trying to find, you know, figure out like, what do they know? What do they don't know? And how can I help make sure that they grow as writers? I spent a lot of time trying to experiment and trial and error on how to do that.
Yeah, that I think is a really good thing, that experimenting with trial and error, because I feel like sometimes as educators, we're supposed to feel like we know everything, that we, especially educational leaders, we're supposed to know everything, know how to do everything, know all the rules of things. And without that kind of practice and experimentation and play, we aren't actually growing our own instructional practices. We don't learn anything new without practicing. Like, I am thinking of a podcast that I love listening to, The Hidden Brain. And on one episode, it was called Learning from Our Mistakes. And the guest that they had on was somebody who studied the psychology of making mistakes. And she said that she really is not a good swimmer as an adult, even though she took a whole lot of swim classes when she was young. But the end of the swim classes were always whatever stroke you just learned, I'm just going to tell you right now, you don't have to use it. Just see who's the fastest to the end of the wall. So she never had practice with these strokes. She just had like whatever way you can get to the end of the wall fastest. And she was always the one to be the fastest. So she really didn't practice strokes. And it's the same thing with educators. Like, we need to feel like we have some elbow room to practice, to experiment, to see the outcomes and then revise those outcomes or revise the instruction in response to those outcomes.
Man, that, and now actually I'm thinking about that analogy about swimming the fastest and use whatever you can. That describes a school year to a T almost. That's what it feels like. It's like, here's ready, set, go. And then you're speeding up, and you're just using whatever you can to get to this, to the state assessment, or, you know, to have the students grasp onto whatever they can. Often it feels like that, which saddens me in so many ways. Like, it feels the pace of what, and the expectation. I think that there's that idea of the expectation. That's a whole other podcast, by the way, but I just loved that analogy that you said. I want to talk a little bit about something you think that, and we can even, because we have a lot of listeners that are educational leaders, that maybe they weren't an English teacher, or they didn't have that background in reading and literacy instruction. What do you think that educational leaders, or even just educators in general, are misunderstanding about writing instruction?
Yes.
That may be a really big question. Tackle what you can.
Okay. I think one of the things that has been around, and I kind of did a historical deep dive into this, since the late 1800s, has been the approach of assign and correct, not to get too harsh, but I also hear it called assign an autopsy. It's like we're finding out what's wrong after we've handed something in, rather than having support and feedback throughout the process. Throughout the writing process. And that could be a very slow writing process. That could be a faster writing process. But we need to have kids practice writing in abundance. And if we have, say, one writing piece for an entire marking period, that is not giving them the practice that they need. The types of feedback we give in that process, if it's corrective, like fix this, fix this, fix this, even though it's face-to-face ideally, it's not as effective as just simply shifting our lens and our wording to go with that lens and saying, here's what's going well in your writing. Here's what's strong. Because you're doing this, here's a next step for you. Changes the game completely. So that means that the third thing that I think is a big misunderstanding in terms of teaching writing is that teachers feel like we are the editor in chief, and that must be our job. And that correction is teaching, and it's not. So we need to look at the writer and then the writing. Our job is to teach the writer to become a stronger writer. So I have another analogy. My father, for years, which was so precious, would crochet. He crocheted blankets, never any other genre, but blanket. And my Aunt Helen, who's a sister-in-law and a master crocheter, would come and help him periodically. And she would come with the mindset, and she wasn't a teacher. She was a homemaker and an amazing crocheter. She came with the mindset that she wasn't here to make the perfect blanket. She was here to help my dad learn to become a better crocheter. So she looked to him first, and then the blanket, and then chose one thing to teach. And was okay with the rest of it, the way that it was, so that we could drill down into that one thing, get really good at it, and then teach them how to transfer that as they learn another skill. And so I think that that's one of the things too, that's a misunderstanding of writing instruction, that instruction is turning out perfect papers, perfect pieces. And there really is no such thing. So I just want to share with you in my latest book, Not Your Granny's Grammar, my co-author, Tim Donahue, we teamed up because he knows more about grammar than anyone I've ever met in my life. And he read and reread and reread our manuscript. And he was like, I think it's good to go. And then it went in for line edit and copy edit. And when we got to copy edit, we had a significant amount of edits that we needed to polish. And so right there with one of the smartest grammar people in the world as part of this collaboration, still needed feedback or correction really is what it was. So if we are expecting any of our students to be writing in a way that is quote unquote perfect, we may not be really looking at the content of the writing, and we may not be looking at the writer first. We're probably looking at, is the grammar as perfect as I think it should be?
Well, and I think there's two different things in here: correcting grammar or teaching them about grammar skills. I mean, that's a that's a deep well or Pandora's box. Sometimes that's what I would encounter of like, there's so much that we can work on. And I would be like, okay, mm-hmm. I have to pick one thing. What I can pick one thing that I'm going to point out, or I'm going to look at, is there a theme I'm seeing in all the papers? And we're going to do a little small lesson, some direct instruction about this one thing. And they're going to go back and make some corrections or fix some things. But I also, the other piece of it is like their ideas and understanding with young writers. Like I always felt like if their writing was, the more personal their writing was, the less I did on the correct and red pen. And the more I asked questions about what was their, what were they trying to articulate? Because correcting, I always felt, would shut that down, especially for writers who are more, I call them dependent writers, the people who were just less confident about their writing skills. So I do understand there's a difference between correcting for those grammar pieces. Mm-hmm. And I like that you sort of talked about focusing on one thing or focusing on the writer more than those things, making perfect writing. And you're right. There's no, mm-hmm. No matter what writing that I have, there's always something that can be improved. That's always where like you could take a test, it's over, it's done. But like writing something felt like I could always, I just had to hand it in. I had to hit submit at some point.
100%. And this is my third book and not a boatload of blog posts that I've written. And every single time, the same thing. And every time post publication, I'm like, ooh, could have done that, that, added that. But it's just a reality we need to write with. And what do they say? It's not finished, it's just due. It's not done, it's just due.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so speaking of grammar, I mean, I want to ask a little bit about, you know, teaching grammar in isolation, because sometimes I think back about some of my grammar instruction that I had, and it was very much kind of in isolation. It would be worksheets or we had workbooks. You know, it doesn't always seem to stick because there's some grammar rules I didn't remember before I had to start teaching them. How do you feel like teachers can weave grammar in authentically in a way that maybe would feel more useful for students?
So I don't think of this as grammar in isolation, but I do think that grammar needs its own pocket of attention. So let's say 10 minutes, 3 to 5 times a week, and we are thinking of grammar in a 6-week unit with related concepts. Let's say simple, compound, and complex sentences. And we are studying those with different entry points over time for 10 minutes, like literally set a timer. When we're done, we're done. We're not looking for mastery during those 10 minutes. We're simply looking for time to be exposed to important grammatical concepts. And when we are doing that with the different experiences that they have across this unit, which include getting curious, explicit teaching, play, not games, but playing with lots of grammar manipulatives that help us create the things that we're learning about without having to just go from here to here. So there's a nice scaffold in there. Some reflection really makes for a big difference in terms of making the most of the time that grammar deserves, but also then having enough background knowledge of grammar to be able to teach it into the writing that we're doing.
That is actually great advice, because I think that it often felt overwhelming, whereas there's so much, and I only have 45 minutes a day as a, you know, we could be talking about middle school or upper elementary and high school, you know, you'd only have so much time with students, and it feels like a lot, but I like that kind of breakdown and the idea of exposing them to those concepts.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful tier one kind of support that can really have a lot of impact on student learning, especially those students that we're looking more closely at that perhaps might need some extra supports put into place, especially if it's for writing. If we back up and we study a little grammar, it makes writing a lot easier. There's much more fluent writing, and that's part of the challenge, is getting pencil to paper, fingers to keyboard to get those ideas out. But if we have sentence structure that we can rely upon, that could be very helpful in starting us off and keeping us moving.
Well, and I even think of just that, I think exposure to model sentences. Mm-hmm. This is what a good complex sentence looks like. Even mm-hmm. that kind of exposure is so helpful for students, because if they're not exposed to that kind of, you know, that kind of writing, then that they won't know. I always felt like I had more success with writing instruction when I modeled for them what it looked like. Because even if they sort of duplicated almost exactly what I was doing, but maybe put in their own words, it gave them a place to start. And that, I mean, I was always like, you listened.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, you were talking about feedback earlier, and it can be tricky. And so I'm curious about what are some examples that you have about how teachers could give feedback on writing that actually helps students grow? And, you know, we touched on this a little bit, but is there any more about how you give feedback, some different ways that you've seen successful?
Yes. So starting first with the mindset, I'm here to teach the writer, not perfect the writing. So we have to have that in our mind because we know what our thoughts will drive our actions. And so even if it's like we have a clipboard and we might have places to jot down what we've taught students or some struggles we're seeing, maybe having that at the top of the page or a little mantra in our minds. And then I sit down and I choose a focus before I even begin the conversation. So perhaps my focus is punctuation. I might say to the writer, and usually when this is practiced over time, it takes less than 5 minutes to have this type of conversation. So I might look to the writer and say, what have you done to punctuate? And they might look at their writing and look at that. I haven't really punctuated much. Or they might say, well, I put periods here. And whatever it is that they're saying, I started with a focus. So I'm not having them read the whole piece to me and I'm not reading the whole piece to myself. I'm starting with a focus. And so let's just say they say, there isn't a lot of punctuation in here. And I'll say, all right, well, first of all, I want to tell you what's strong. Have all this writing down. Getting the writing down out of your mind onto a page is actually really difficult. So because you've done that, you're ready to think about punctuation. Because you have, you're ready for. Not because, but. We're keeping the word but out of it. Instead, because you have that, you are ready to add more punctuation. And then you just talked about modeling and how helpful that is. So you might model a couple of steps. Here's how I add punctuation. First, I read. Second, I notice, and if we're studying grammar on the side, I noticed a complete sentence. Third, I pick the type of punctuation I'd like to use and show that in my writing, coach them a little bit in their writing to try it, then leave them. And after I've seen maybe a couple of other kids coming back to see how it goes. So something very simple, start with a focus, ask about the focus, name a strength, model, give the kids a chance to try.
I
like
that.
My favorite.
Yeah. Well, and I think even I like the idea. I always found that active feedback that was happening while they're doing their writing, because we talked about not just doing it afterwards. Number one, to sit down with a huge stack of essays to create is very time consuming. And so I often felt I'm going to start that feedback process before I even get it so that I can, you know, help them. And I found that my students like that a lot better. Like it's almost like that little kid of going, am I doing this right? Am I doing this? They want that reassurance as they go, provides them more confidence. So there's so many of our audience members that are school and district leaders. And so I would love for you to talk a little bit how you feel like that and those people in those roles, how do you feel like they can help support strong writing instruction?
Yeah. Oh gosh, I have so many ideas for that. But one in particular that comes to mind is something that I often create for schools. I mean, school leaders can do this themselves as well, is a professional learning plan. So the way that this learning plan looks is first we've decided on a goal or focus. And let's say our focus is strengthening writing instruction or making writing instruction more student-centered. We don't want it to sound like a deficit because there isn't. The teachers are showing up, they're teaching. So we've got some good things in place. And then within that learning plan, we have our goal, and then we have learning cycles. So we might have, let's say we're in trimesters, and we might go through a trimester similarly to students, where we might have opportunities as a school leader to study a particular text, to watch a video about it, a peer practice in a classroom with whatever that focus is, to get some informal, non-observational feedback, and then to reflect on maybe how we've grown in that area, and then going on to cycle two. And then I give like explanation for like why we chose that using some research. I take into account and ask for some feedback from teachers on the things that they find most useful in professional learning. But just having a document that becomes a touchstone document. I learned this from when I was still working in, you know, one school instead of many. My principal did this, and it was a lot of spinning wheels beforehand, a lot of us trying to do the same sort of thing, but in our own, I guess, room and kind of area. But she pulled a bunch of us together. We composed this learning plan. It was one of the first times we ever saw those who were teaching literacy come together because we had a very clear vision. And then she used it and did not move away from it. Obviously, she had to talk about other things that are school related, but she always made sure that this was something that she used throughout the year. So that is a very concrete and very handy tool for leaders if they're looking to really get serious about any type of learning that they want to happen in schools.
Yeah. Well, and I always find that when the leader is prioritizing something, it's more likely your teams will begin to prioritize that. You know, and I would say for many people who are teaching reading and writing, when your leader is supportive of you growing in that area I mean, we know that that's such foundational skills, then it feels like, okay, I'm not here out on a limb on my own trying to figure it out.
Yes.
Because there were years where I felt like that, where it's like, oh, I have to figure out how to be a reading specialist when I really learned how to teach literature. And I didn't learn this, but when I found that when I had years where my leader was like, yes, this is a priority. And whether it be supporting a book club amongst our department or provide what kind of resources do you need, or how can we help that? When they were behind us on those things, it really made a huge difference in our morale and our feeling of like, okay, there's somebody there that's helping us row the boat or even just steering.
Yeah.
I think that makes a big difference for this work, because it can feel really big, especially if you, I would say, you know, we talk about tier one and how some of these, you know, things we've talked about today can really help strengthen that tier one instruction. But when you have a lot of students that are in tier two or falling in the tier two or tier three range, it can feel like we have so much need, but not enough of us to go around. And so I feel like there has to be sort of that focus. Okay, what are we going to prioritize? How are we going to help make this easier for everyone?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I can give you some sample learning plans that you can also put in the show notes.
Yeah.
If for anyone that might want to create something.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Okay. So, you know, we've talked a lot about, well, lots of different things in the spectrum, but I am curious. I want to go back to talking about supporting young writers who might feel nervous and discouraged in their writing early on. And this is one of my favorite topics, supporting young writers.
Yes. Okay. So again, I have a boatload of ideas with this because I've done so much personally and discovered so much professionally when working with other educators. But one of the first things I think we can do is create a feeling tone of neutrality during our writing time, that we don't get too excited about any one thing in kids' writing, and we don't get too upset about anything, any one thing in kids' writing, because writing is the most vulnerable academic act kids take on in schools. And if they know that they're going to be, the response is going to be correction, our stronger writers are only going to go as far as they know is perfect. And our writers that are dormant writers might be, well, I'm not doing this. I'm just going to shut down. I don't have anything to say or to contribute to this. That neutrality is very helpful. Pointing out strengths in a neutral way can make a big difference. This is a couple of years ago, there was a student that teachers that I was working with wanted me to work with. And I was like, when we go into a classroom, my one rule is I don't make any of the students cry. So if this is a student that will cry that I'm sitting with, I do not want this kid in 30 years to be like, there was this curly haired lady who showed up with a bunch of teachers staring at me and talked to me about writing. So that's my only caveat. I love working with any student as long as it doesn't scar them. But this one student, if there was anyone that was looking like they were going to be scarred, it was this one. And Maddie is the name that I've been calling her. Maddie, since the beginning of the year, and this was probably November, had one tiny little sketch in her writer's notebook. And now we were on to an informational writing unit. And I sat down next to her, and she's literally laying over her writer's notebook, arms crossed, head down. And I said, Maddie, could I just peek at your writer's notebook? And she like lifted her elbow, and I saw inside that she had that little sketch. And this was just, I'm telling you the story because it was just like, let me try this, because, you know, everybody's tried everything. I said, Maddie, you look like someone who sketches. And she kind of like lifted her head. I said, so you were sketching part of the story you were telling here. We can use sketches just like you did here to begin our writing and informational writing. So you've got this already. Let me show you how you can do that. And she lifted up her head. I showed her what she could do with sketches to come up with a possible plan. And there was a big shift in her. So that neutral tone, I wasn't like, wow, so great. You make pictures. Woo. Like, it was just, I see you're a writer who, you know, because if there's that excitement on one side, everybody's waiting for the other shoe to drop on the other side, especially the kids who are struggling. So I see you're a writer who, and I'm going to tell you right now, I'm saying this not in a preachy way, because this is my evolution over now 31 years of education. I used to be like, woo, and, you know, get all crazy when there was like a letter written down. For some kids, when that was growth, they didn't want it to be, you know, publicized. But if it was like, oh, look at you, you got started. It's not a public thing. It's just like an acknowledgement. And the neutrality and the looking for what is already happening and working can make a huge difference to our more dormant writers.
Well, and I think in a way you were making writing accessible mm-hmm. in her mind. Mm-hmm. I think that for some students, there's a block there. They're thinking, I can't do that.
Yes.
And so when you say you've already begun, you know, beginning is half the battle. I know as a writer myself, a blank page is often the hardest part for me.
Where and you're not alone.
And I would say there are famous writers that yes. will say that it's like the blank page. There will be so, you know, there's so many, we often think that writers are just typing away all day long. Right. No, like half of writing is just staring going, I need a new idea. And I would often tell that to my students. I started a free write Fridays when I was my last year in the classroom. And it's one of my favorite things I did because I had little writers that they wrote prolifically, not a lot of punctuation, but I told them, I said, just write, you just put it out on the page. And that was part of me preaching to myself as well. So,
yeah, I was just going to add in there. I'm guessing this is all adults listening, but if not, you can edit this out. Just always going back to Anne Lamott's shitty first draft. I mean, it is like the just holy grail of how do we get out of that stuck place?
Yeah. Well, and I think too, is even sometimes I do think students watch the modeling and they think I can't write a paragraph like that. And so what I found that modeling wasn't just giving them the perfect example, but it was, here's a beginner, here's emerging. I tried to use sort of that scale. So to give them a place of like, even if they can't think that they can be perfect, could they fall somewhere else in the spectrum? And I think that even that kind of modeling helps give writers sort of a different picture. It's almost like going to a workout class and you're only seeing this instructor that's super fit and can yes. do all the moves. I love those videos where you would see the person in the background doing the like alternative. And I'm like, I can do that. Like, that's actually sometimes I think really important for us to remember, is just a way to differentiate for our students is to give them an example that's just a step below that perfect one that you want.
I just have to add on to what you're saying, because one of the things I share with teachers all the time is to think of our class like a Zumba room, like it's a Zumba class, and that anytime we teach something, whether it's individually, small group, or whole group, we're going to have the people in the front who like knew this already and maybe a professional dancer by night, colleague of the teacher, the middle of the room who's doing it exactly as she's saying or he's saying, and the back of the room that's just moving, because that's the bottom line, we're just moving. And that's not good, that's not bad, that's just information. And that I think is also what you're talking about with the, beginning and moving on or whatever the categories are. It's just a way to think about it without there being so much emotion around it.
Yeah. And I want to go back to that. I kind of want to end on that phrase that you said about how writing can be one of the most vulnerable things that students do. And I think that I look at myself, my path as a writer, and even before I became a teacher, and just thinking about how that kind of work that we're expecting students to do, like, we have to make sure we create a safe space for that, because that's part of them demonstrating the skill. They need to know it's safe to make mistakes. It's safe to not be perfect. And because if we don't create that psychological safe space, then it does put up that wall, and they're going to retreat and protect themselves. And so maybe like Maddie, just sitting there with her, head over the writer's notebook. And so, which ties into, MTSS and SEL and like it all ties together, that like some of those things have to be in place in order for this kind of work to happen as well. And so, okay, Patty, we could probably talk all day. I love this kind of conversation. This is stuff that I'm really passionate about, as you can tell. And I appreciate you coming on and sharing your resources. I'm so excited to share all the show notes with their audience. And I'm sure that we'll hopefully hear from you again and get to learn from you as well. And I'm excited. I've got your book. I'm going to order it. And because I'm like, I gotta get this resource and share it with my colleagues as well. So
thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Have a great day. Thanks for listening to Schoolin' Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds. Go ahead and subscribe to our feed wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget, if you are enjoying our content, would you do us a favor and rate and review our podcast on iTunes? This helps others find our podcasts and lets us know how much you love what we're creating. Branching Minds is an educational technology company using learning sciences and technology to help districts effectively personalize learning through MTSS. To learn more about us, check out our website, branchingminds.com, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn at Branching Minds.